to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast, a proud member of the Soccer and Sweet Tea Network.
Welcome back to You're Smarter Than Us. I've got Chris with me. Chris, say hello to the folks.
Hey, everybody.
So, Chris, you've been going to all of the men's games this year, and before we talk about the ladies, let's do a little bit of a conversation about the men. The last two games we've had were a 2-1 win against the Emerald Force and a 1-5 loss to Nashville. Do you have any observations or things you've noticed during those games?
Well, one thing I noticed about the Emerald Force game, in correlation to the away game, which we attended, after the game in Knoxville, we had said, you know, that it was current with our strategy of being up a man for, I think, roughly 51 minutes, that the strategy was just not working. And I think we even said about, you know, we clearly had a plan A, but when we didn't get it in 51 minutes, we didn't have a plan B. And you could discuss, you know, what level of strategy do you have at this league, whereas you kind of don't have as much practice time. The guys are kind of being thrown together. They've also just finished a season. And getting them together, it's not like a club team that plays all year round that can have a coach focusing on strategy. So that was one thing that we had talked about. And for the Emerald Force game at home, we definitely responded with a change in strategy. And that is one thing that I think we can definitely give the coach credit, that we witnessed him go into the book and kind of tweak the roster, tweak some players, a little bit of a formation, and we saw results in that game.
Do you think that was more because of the games are coming fast and heavy now? Do you think we rotated because of freshness and legs, or do you think it was, hey, this isn't working, let's go ahead and put N4 on the bench, we moved Rosenwall up top, Cameron Saul was on the right wing, Nathan Watt was on the left wing. So we basically changed our entire front three.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but do we not have a player who played with N4 in college that is hurt currently, or is he back?
Elliot Cutts, he just came back, and he's been featuring on our bench somewhat. He was up top. I think he came in when we played Knoxville away towards the end of that game trying to make something happen. So, yeah, they do have kind of some sort of natural chemistry, but we haven't really seen them put up top as a unit yet, per se.
Right, and I think that's largely due to his injury. Now, before I address what you were saying, I also spoke with Cameron Saul after one of the games, and I know that he is nursing a knee injury. Now, I don't know if it's something, obviously we saw him come in and be a dominant force in that game at home against Emerald Force, but we haven't been seeing him feature regularly, and you can see the impact he had when he came in. He's a lot different player than N4, and it was definitely obvious that we've been missing Cameron Saul. To ingress, or to go with what you were saying, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, the games are coming in fast and heavy, which obviously people are going to be tired. You're dealing with little knocks you pick up and whatnot. But I honestly think that when you saw N4 come off the bench, I think that that was a direct change in strategy there. So to answer your question, yes, I think you are seeing a switching of the squad to, you know, give people a little bit more breather and give them some time. And you're also seeing, I think to say earlier, basically you're seeing the strategy develop in front of our eyes. You know, you don't know what players are going to work where and what formation is going to work what. So it is kind of a trial and error sort of way of strategizing the team. So I think, you know, what we saw really did work in the Knoxville game, whatever that may be, a little combination of both or whatever, but whatever it was, you got the result.
Yeah, that game was definitely marred, too, by the 64th minute injury. There was a, if I'm remembering this correctly, a ball into the box, and it looked almost like their keeper came out and tried to punch the ball and accidentally hit one of his own players. He went down. He was down for an extended period of time, ended up having to, unfortunately, be stretchered off. We have not been able to get an update about him. But after that, everything kind of slowed down and seemed to be kind of molasses-y. There was no pace to the game. There was no momentum anymore. But I do agree that before that, Cameron Saul had the two beautiful, had a brace, two beautiful goals. I think he basically created both of them himself. One of them, he kind of picked the ball up on the edge of the box and then dribbled into the middle of the box and shot one in below the keeper. And then the second one, he got put through by someone who I'm forgetting and just rifled it right past. He definitely, you're 100% right, he provides something that this team has not had. We have all of these speedy wingers. We have finesse play on the outside with kind of Joiner on the left and Bolin on the right of our midfield. Bruno Andrade on the right wing is technically sound, but he's not a large guy. So Cameron Saul is providing that big body. And as you've seen just throughout the course of the season, everybody across the entire NPSL seems to have just gotten bigger, especially the defenses, our defense included. And I don't feel like our strategy of knocking balls into the box, whether it be crosses or trying to do these little 1-2 link-up plays into N4, has provided much in way of getting closer and closer to the box to slot one in. Cameron Saul is just a unit. You know, he can create his own shot. He has the frame to battle off a defender or two and wiggle his way in and create his own shot. Now, all of this said, we did go to Nashville on Saturday night, and we deployed a similar-looking lineup. Rosenwald back up top. Saul was nursing that injury, so he wasn't in the squad whatsoever. We had Andrade out on the right, and we lost pretty soundly 5-1 to Nashville. There was no stream of that game, so we can't really talk too much to the actual tactics and what happened. But I do want to kind of get your opinion, Chris, on something that I had not previously seen in the NPSL, which was Inter-Nashville announced the morning of the game that they welcomed in 4 transfers from Nashville FC. They welcomed in Hal McGrath, Dustin, and a gentleman whose name I cannot pronounce. It looks extremely German. But what ended up happening is all 4 of those players did feature in that game. And I believe McGrath or Howell either had 2 goals. One of them had another goal. And then I believe McGrath provided 2 assists. Is this just a product of kind of the Wild Wild West nature of the NPSL? Have you ever seen this happen before?
Well, I've never heard of that, and we know that there is a giant talent gap, not to discredit our guys, but there is a talent gap between USL and NPSL. Before I get into that, and I just wanted to kind of address this a little bit in terms of the games being fast and furious kind of in the slot here of the summer, do you know exactly what temperature it was at game time during the Nashville game? Because I know on Saturday in Asheville, it was about 90 here. As you go west towards Nashville, because I've actually went to some U.S. men's games in Nashville, it's really hot there. It gets really
The Knoxville game was borderline obnoxious with how hot it was at kickoff.
And I would honestly like to think that the Nashville game was probably hotter. You're taking traveling. I mean, you're traveling, 5 hours to Nashville? They probably they probably traveled there, got on the field, practiced for a little bit, and then played in what I'm guessing to be above 90-degree heat. Now, I don't remember there being a water break at the Knoxville game. At kickoff, it was 88, I think. I think is what I remember. It was 88 degrees at kickoff. Do you remember a water break during that game?
I do not. I actually do remember, I believe, Lucas Joyner starting to cramp up, and he actually asked us, the fans, if any of us had a Gatorade. And during a possession of play, a segment of play where the ball was actually on the left wing, he grabbed a Gatorade from one of us and drank it down real quick before rejoining the play.
I do remember that.
Yeah.
I do remember that. I do remember that. So I'm sure the elements were just brutal on the on our boys in Nashville. And then getting back to what you had said about making an adjustment to the roster mid-season, bringing guys from USL. Now, what is their connection to the USL team? Do they have two teams that, like a minor league, and or is it a loose connection, or what is the connection?
Yeah, there, other than the fact that they play in the same city, there is no connection whatsoever. This is something that I actually wonder, maybe it happens all the time and we're just not aware of it, but I would not be surprised whatsoever if this is something that kind of moving forwards we see more of. Greenville obviously has their NPSL team, but they're about to get their USL team. In a couple, or actually it's not the USL, I forget what it is, but they're about to get a third tier team above the NPSL team, and I would not be shocked to see if they kind of have this loose agreement of, hey, these guys, now to be fair, these four players that did transfer apparently were not featuring for Nashville FC very often, so it was possibly a way of, hey, you guys aren't breaking the starting squad. I don't even know if they're being named in the game day squad, even on the bench. So maybe it was just a way of, hey, let's keep you guys active. Let's keep you in the community. Let's get you out there. But the ownership teams are different. And as far as I'm aware of, there was no previous sort of cooperation along these lines.
That's very interesting. I mean, that just, you know, I am a little bit familiar with the USL. I follow the Charleston Battery a little bit. And I know their squads are huge. And also in the USL, you'll have, you know, Red Bulls B, Orlando City B. So, you know, coming from MLS. So I know that there is a lot of trading between rosters with clubs that are one club. I mean, it's Red Bulls coming from MLS with Red Bulls B playing in ULS. So obviously it's the same ownership, same team. And it is, you know, they are going back and forth and they shift players down, you know, much like the minor league system, with baseball, in the Astros, Taurus and whatnot. We see that happen a lot. But it would really just shock me, that without there being a link in ownership, unless it was just something that they signed them and they, you know, they just signed them to be on that team. But, you know, that's something that we're definitely going to have to ask our ownership about, and I would really like to divvy into the facts a little bit there, because it does seem a little bit unfair, or if unfair is not the word, let's just say it's a gray area. I mean, if you, you know, it's a gray area to just bring in these players. I would like to know how they did it on, by documentations, should I say. Like, how was it documented? Are they on the roster now? Are they not? Are they still on the USL roster? You know, just as long as we have a little bit of clarity, you know, amongst that, because that doesn't seem fair to NPSL players, you know, who are working, you know, working themselves, just got done with school, and now, you know, they're playing against surprise USL players that are obviously, like you said, these guys didn't come in and just say, well, it didn't affect the game. We had two goals from the one guy, also an assist from him as well, possibly. I mean, so you saw a direct result from that move. And that, you know, like you had said, the Wild West of the NPSL. You know, what is the legislation there that regulates roster, you know, roster moves like that? That would be something that we would have to look into.
Yeah, I think it's also just kind of a perfect example of the unpredictability of this league. As we sit here today, and we do play a pair of games this week, I believe on Tuesday we play Nashville again at home, and then on Saturday we play Greenville. But as we sit, Asheville is sitting fifth in the table with 1.33 points per game. And we are barely above Georgia Revs in Greenville at 1.2 and 1.125 respectively. And just above us, we've got Atlanta at 1.5, Nashville at 1.6, and New Orleans at 1.7. Chattanooga is at 1.875. So everything's still kind of up there to play for. It can you kind of describe a little bit of what you've seen in terms of how nobody's really running away from the league? You know, we had a draw and a close loss to Chattanooga, the table leaders, a win and a loss to Emerald Forest, the bottom of the table. Does this table just kind of cannibalize itself, or does the cream rise to the kind of top?
Well, I think you're going to see that in this league every year to a degree. You know, like, for example, last year, you know, we saw Atlanta Silverbacks that were a dominant team. And I went to that playoff game with a great group of fans. And you could see that even though we gave it our all and we gave it everything we had, they were bigger, stronger, and faster than we were in that playoff game. And it just showed. I mean, they could have scored 2 to 3 goals there, but it wasn't. It was a closer result. But now you see the Atlanta Silverbacks this year, they don't look anything like the team we saw last year. Nothing at all like the team we saw last year. So I think with the MPSL in general, Steve, you're going to have every year is a crapshoot, and you're going to be, you know, to a degree starting from square one, even though you could see we brought back some players. But we have a new coach, and we have a lot of other players that are new. And it seems like every team does. I think I was seeing somewhere that the Georgia Revolution, who were just terrible last year.
They didn't win a single game all year, and they've already won three this year.
Exactly. And it seemed like they, from what I've heard and read, had picked up some players from the Atlanta Silverbacks and actually brought some of their players in. So you're seeing a shift of that. And every season, it seems like we're going to be witnessing that. But to move on to what we're looking at right now at the table and what we're looking at the teams, you know, before we went to the Knoxville game, we were looking at Knoxville and saying, oh, they only had one win. It was against Greenville, and they were down a guy.
Yep.
And then we play them, and you're like, I don't see that in this squad. You know, and that's what you're saying. It's from the bottom to the top, this is an evenly matched conference. These teams, no matter what their record on any given day, it seems, can come out and put in a performance. I mean, you look at Chattanooga, they're scrimmaging against FC Dallas. They're playing against, FC Detroit, and they're going to be moved up there. You know, they're a great team there. They played St. Pauli from Germany. They're playing high-profile games, and they're still. We won one, and we played them at home. It was a very close game. We weren't far from the pack from them. We were right there with them, and they were big. They're, like you were speaking earlier, you know, these defenders that we're seeing, I don't know if I didn't see it last year or not, but they look like giants. I mean, one of the guys from Chattanooga, I think he had to be 6'5". I mean, he was a giant guy. It's unbelievable. So I think every game matters, and there isn't going to be a clear-cut favorite. You know, I think you can see flashes of talent. You can see players that are teams that are coming together and gelling. But I think from top to bottom, we are a pretty even conference. And I don't think that, you know, you can take anybody for granted. I know when we went to the Knoxville game, and I think the players themselves might have thought that. Oh, we're playing a team we're definitely better than. No. It's not cut and dry. It's not black and white like that in the MPSL, and you can clearly see that. So that's how I'm kind of looking at it now. I just look at it completely differently. I don't look at who's at the bottom, who's at the top. It's game by game, what performance we put on that day.
So where do you see the difference in quality between the NPSL and the WPSL? Because I think one of the things we've just seen on the pitch, without a shadow of a doubt, is that the way the women are playing, you know, thrown together in the same kind of haphazard, I'm fascinated. I got to talk to Jimmy Wheeler this past weekend a little bit about how the teams recruit, and I think that lends itself to the turnover you were talking about, because so much of it has to do with some of the players are from Asheville, some of the players have ties to the coach, so the ties that the players had to last year's coach from Mars Hill is different than our coach now, who's from Wake Forest and had, you know, stints at UNCA and those showcases and the different places he's been. But the women's team, we are doing nothing but getting results. We drew midweek, unfortunately, against who do we draw against? Beaufort
County.
Was
that South Carolina team, I believe.
Yeah. And then we went to Charlotte yesterday and played the co-table leaders with the Carolina Rapids and just absolutely put it on them. 5-1 win. Their goal was kind of a consolation goal, I think, in the 82nd, 83rd minute. We were up 4-0, I believe, 25 minutes in. So where do you see that massive kind of gap in quality between the men's squad and the women's squad, or is the women's squad just playing together as a unit already and getting those results?
You know, that's a really interesting question. And I going into this season, I was so excited about having a women's team. You know, I have women athletes in my family, and I was really excited to get a women's team. And I really didn't know, you know, where we were going to go with this, how they would stack up, you know, what talent they had, where they were recruiting from. But after watching the games and us getting to mid-season, it is so obvious that we are watching a very talented team. And I'm not focusing on the word team. I'm focusing on the word talented. Individually, the women are phenomenal, individually. And that is something to do with the league. If you look at it, say, for example, the path of a male soccer player in the United States. Let's use Christian Pulisic, for example. He's good, 18 years old. I think there's a clause whenever you're allowed to leave. I think it's 17 with parental guardian or something, but it's, you know, you can't leave at 12 like you can in other places. In the United States, there's definitely rules on that. You're 18 years old. Christian Pulisic's not thinking about going to Penn State University to play Division I soccer. You know, but the path of a great female soccer player in the United States is to play university soccer. I mean, you look at Alex Morgan, who's arguably our most, you know, prolific player right now. You know, I think her salary is somewhere near $400,000. I mean, she's definitely, you know, doing well for herself playing pro. But, you know, she was a university player. Sydney LaRue, another, you know, great player and kind of face of the U.S. team, you know, she played university soccer. I believe she went to UCLA. So what we're seeing is that a lot of these players are really good Division I players. I mean, I'm not sure she's a center back, I believe, Bigham, a University of North Carolina player, who scored the goal against South Carolina this past week. I mean, she is a dominant defender, just absolutely amazing talent. I mean, we have the female player, Parker Roberts, who has been featuring on the U.S. women's team under 20, under 23s regularly since 2016, I believe. So, you know, you're looking at players who are using this league to really showcase their skills because they are that talented. And there aren't a million options for the women to play, whereas you're playing Division II Germany or, you know, Bundesliga or whatever. If you're a young men's player, we have a few young U.S. players that are, you know, teetering in, you know, lower divisions all over Europe. But that's not really the path that a lot of our great women soccer players are going down. So to our advantage, you're seeing that on the field. I mean, these players are top quality, and they're young as well. So one thing that I think when we're watching the women's team and we're looking at them, you know, we're seeing players that are may or may not, but high likelihood, if that's what they want, to go on to greater things. U.S. team, possibly going up in the league with Alex Morgan and Sydney LaRue and that league, or having opportunities to play in Europe. You know, you're seeing a pickup in the English female English league, you're seeing that pick up. You're seeing it pick up in France as well, with teams like PSG picking up teams and loading them with talent and whatever. So you're looking at a rise in women's soccer, and it's a beautiful thing because in Asheville, we're actually witnessing it firsthand, and we're watching it play out, and I feel very privileged to be doing that.
Yeah, I have to 100% agree with you on this also, because there's 9 professional women's teams, and if they have 40-person rosters, then there are 360 women professional soccer players in this country. If I'm not mistaken,
wow.
I believe soccer, yeah, if I'm not mistaken, though, soccer is just about one of the number one female sports in the country, because it does have that kind of youth structure that promotes the intergender play up to a certain level, and then once you hit secondary school, it breaks down. But almost every college has a women's soccer team. And when you start to go into the tiers of it, there's 117 WPSL teams, which provides, you know, different levels of competition within them. We're kind of seeing it with Jennifer Cujo, who has played for other WPSL teams and now has come to Asheville to, you know, spend her time here. She's also coaching with Asheville Shield. That's another subject for another time, because I'm just so glad there's that professionalism here teaching the next generation. But you're 100% right. If you do want to go on to play professionally in any country, the WPSL is where you've got to kind of make your mark. And so I've had this discussion with Pat in the past where, you know, if a male player in the NPSL who is about to go into his senior year of college is running down a ball and finds himself in a 50-50 situation, I'm not questioning his intent, but there has to be a belief, just like a professional player would have maybe in a contract year, of how far am I laying myself out for this ball for an NPSL team when my college career, my last season is on the horizon. I'm worried about this. I'm worried about that. Whereas the women, this is where they can make their mark. They can make their mark in college to a certain level, and then this is that next level. And if you're going to crack that
career building, their career
plan. Yeah, exactly. So if you're going to crack that top 360 or venture off into another country to potentially play for one of their teams, you have to go after that 50-50 ball. And I think we're seeing the results of that on the pitch.
Oh, I would 100% agree with you. The intensity that the women play with is next level. It really, really, really is. Now, I don't think that the men's team, I wouldn't think, you know, when you're a player, and I don't know what, you know, what team sports you've played, but, you know, I know that it seems like I've played soccer, I've played basketball, I've played baseball, different teams throughout high school and into college, and, you know, you have that drive that you can't shut off. So I don't think, you know, in terms of are we seeing a different of intensity commitment based upon, you know, league, because of the women have more of a platform, and this is more of a platform for them to perform versus the men. I think it's just when you get into a higher level, and not to knock the men's team at all, but, you know, we're looking at pedigree with a lot of these women. You know, players that have been great in high school, they are great for their college, and then they're coming here and they're being great for us too. And we're seeing that. And when you go up tiers, you see that fight and drive in players, that's what gets them to that point. Because that drive and that push is strong. And you see that with the women's team. Now, when we brought up the Jennifer, who played different NPSL teams. Now, is her home country Ghana?
Yeah, yeah.
Now,
she capped for them a few times and
was
their female footballer of the year in 2015.
See, that's what I was wondering, and I know that I didn't know how, you know, how it developed with the Women's World Cup. Did Ghana reach the Women's World Cup the last time around? I can't remember.
I'm not sure, but she played for their U20 and I think their U23. So I don't know if she actually went on.
Yeah,
I know she played in what I'm assuming is basically their version of like the Toulon tournament that a lot of the European U teams play. I think she played in that, the women's version of that. I think it was in Canada or somewhere, but I don't think Ghana did particularly well in that tournament.
Okay. Well, we do have a women's World Cup coming up. So I'm wondering if, you know, she'll still be in the circuit during the qualifying, the African Cup qualifying there and whatnot. You know, one thing I'm going to bring up here, just as, you know, food for thought, it, kind of going back to what we were saying, you know, we had Manny Perez. You know, he was a Division I NC State player, freshman of the year or AC player of the year. I'm not sure. It was one of the two.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had some offers from, I believe, clubs. He was, I don't believe he ever featured for the U.S. Men's under 23 team or 20 team, but he was with them, traveling with them, played in France, did something in Honduras with them. But as soon as he kind of got a little bit of starlight to know that that, you know, his path was kind of opening up, like you said, the MPSL disappeared. Because for a player like that, he was not going to risk, you know, hey, a hamstring, it happens, it's hot, it's humid, you're cramping up. He wasn't going to risk a silly foul from someone who comes in and clips his knee or clips something and when he's on the path of something like that. But
you could absolutely see the defenses he was playing against almost every time. He played for us for two games, Georgia Revs and then that second Chattanooga game. And you could see every time a defender, if he got the ball, they wanted to make a name for themselves. They wanted to be able to tell their buddies back at home that they tackled Manny Perez, that they stole the ball from Manny Perez. So, yeah, I think you're 100% on to something right there.
And he was gone. And that's a smart, I mean, you got to make, that's career choices. And it was great. It's going to be a little blip on his sheet if he goes on. I think I had heard he had some sort of career with Villarreal out of Spain and possibly my home club of Celtic FC out of Glasgow. Those kind of teams that were looking for him. And I know both of those clubs do play a lot of young talent and do work a lot of young talent. They're kind of both known for that. But to pivot from where I'm going to, you know, where I'm going with this, is, you know, you look at a player like Parker Roberts, who her career playing with the U.S. women's team was a little bit, you know, a little bit more advanced than Manny's. I mean, if you look at her career with them, she's had some caps. She's been going to their camps. She's been getting call-ups from them. And you see, she's on the team and fully committed to us. And you can see it on the field. So with that difference, that's a prime example of what you were just speaking about the division of players and, you know, not wanting to risk getting hurt or, you know, opportunities ahead and career building. That's a perfect example of that. Because you have a player like her who, you know, is good enough. She has caps. She has features. But she's coming here still to career build. Still to give it 110% every time she's out on the field, despite what she's done, you know, in her national, you know, her national caps. So I think that right there is just a perfect example of someone who has national team experience, has played more, and someone who just got the opportunity. As soon as they got the opportunity, they said, "Hey, I'm done with this. I can't risk getting injured." But we have someone who has played, probably will continue to play for them as well, but still is very content with being an Asheville City player. And that is something that is just, you know, as we really get moving in years to come, we're only in year one of the women's and year two of the men's, I think that's something that we're really going to see with the women's team is some really great players wearing the blue and white of Asheville City on the women's team. And that's something that, you know, we can really be excited about as fans.
Yeah, certainly as we continue to build the brand and more, you know, more players out there continue to hear about us. I forget what team it was that came to play in Asheville the squad visited Asheville, and I believe we beat them. But they went home, and on their way home, you could see tweet after tweet after tweet from their players, even though we beat them, talking about how great it was to finally play in front of a loud crowd that was invested in the game. And that's the sort of thing that I truly, truly, truly believe, that once that gets out there, once people know, once players know, hey, let's go to Asheville for the summer, live in a beautiful city with lots to do, and play in front of knowledgeable, enthusiastic fans that actually care. That's
you
going
literally
to bring
took the words
even
right out
more
of my mouth.
People
I mean,
out
honestly,
of here.
Honestly, that's exactly where I was going to go. And I'll add this into that to add to make it a little bit juicier here. We are in a prime recruiting area. I mean, you're looking at SEC at your doorway and ACC at your doorway. Two of the biggest athletic conferences in the United States, period, but also two of the biggest conferences in soccer. I mean, all of the ACC teams are good. I mean, both women's and men's, they're all good. Clemson has a fantastic team as well. So we are in a prime location for recruiting. And like you said, I mean, just point blank, we go to that Knoxville game. Now, minus Chattanooga, you know, they have some nice fans. They have great fans there. We got to give them credit for that. They really know how to put on a show, and they're great. But even with Chattanooga being said, I honestly think I know Memorial Stadium is not the greatest thing in the world. I understand that. But I think personally that the atmosphere at Memorial Stadium is better than the atmosphere at Chattanooga. Why do I say that? Because when you come into Asheville City and you come into Memorial Stadium, even though it's small, we are surrounding that field. The bleachers are full. The concrete section of seating is full. There is standing room only. It is full. You are not seeing an empty space. If you look out as a player and you do a 360 turn, it is fans stacked around you, yelling, screaming, cheering you on. And that is something that you're not getting. In retrospect to Chattanooga, that stadium is huge. I mean, we went there for a game, the first edition of the Blue Ridge Derby or whatever. And yeah, they had a ton of fans. But you know what? They had a whole entire section of stadium where there wasn't anyone sitting. So, I mean, you know, even though they're bigger, they get maybe have a little bit more of a turnout with the look. Our atmosphere for a game, let's not talk about where we're located in the mountains of Asheville, but for a game, I would think we have the best atmosphere in our conference. I'm not going to go outside of that because I haven't been to the games and I don't know about what else is going on. I've heard other things that the MPSL is kind of getting some momentum in some, you know, in some places, but I think we have the best. Now, as you were saying, put that in perspective. Okay, we have a great atmosphere. Like you said, you're going to have great fans, knowledgeable fans. They're going to support you. They're going to come to team events. You know, you're going to be treated like gold to a certain degree for MPSL status. But not to mention where we're located. We're 10 degrees cooler than anywhere else. It's a fantastic summer location. There's nothing but stuff to do. Music, this, that. In the little bit of time that you have off time, it's like a summer vacation. You go to Knoxville or go to... I mean, you're a player for the Georgia Revolution. You're north of Atlanta. I mean, what? Come on now. You come to Asheville, and you're playing in a great atmosphere, soccer atmosphere, and the location is beautiful. So I've had actually this conversation with a few people before about, like, you know, this is going to be a desired location to play. It is. It has to be. It will be. And we're going to see a lot of players come for that exact reason. And how many fans, I mean, you know, we've seen a bunch of games together this year and last year. And how many times have we actually heard, like you had said earlier, the opposing team be happy to be playing here? They might have lost. They might have lost. They might have been barraged with, you know, comments. They might not have been kosh. We don't know, but at the end of the game, I know I've had more than one goalie turn around and clap the crowd, clap the people, shake hands, and actually say, wow, I wish I could play this atmosphere every game. So that's something that we're definitely going to reap the benefits of, and rightfully so.
And it sounds like Greenville is actually kind of replicating that environment, too. Of course, they are playing at Furman, so the stadium is a little bit nicer than Memorial. It's just updated, truly. Of course, they don't have the option, though, because it is a college. They actually have what's basically the equivalent of a beer jail, that if you have a beer, you have to stay within this certain part. But it just sounds like they're wrapping their heads around their supporter groups. The Milltown operatives are doing a good job creating that environment down there, and I could not be more excited for the game on Saturday. We've got a good crowd of them coming up. It is going to be a friendly rivalry as opposed to kind of what has developed between us and Atlanta and their, you know, strange group of four ultras that tend to follow them around like a lost puppy. But, Chris, I want to say thank you for hopping on with me. I deeply, deeply appreciate it. I know you're welcome on anytime you want. Guys, please catch us at the next game. We play on Tuesday. We play on Thursday, and then we play on Tuesday again. Chris, thank you again, and I'll be seeing you at the game.
Thanks for having me, and it has been great, and we'll definitely catch up, and let's go Blues, and I'll see you tomorrow.
All right, brother.
Bye.
You've been listening to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast, a proud member of the Soccer and Sweet Tea Network. Thank you to Audionautics for our music, and find us on social media at your_smarter on Twitter and at yoursmarterthanus@gmail.com.